This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
With this agreement, they are happy because they think this is a vast victory as long as the Prime Minister and the Minister of Council at least will be technocrats, so they put great hopes that they might change the situation.
That's reporter Naba Mohadin on the mood in Khartoum as a new Prime Minister is nominated and preparations are underway for a signing ceremony on a deal to move Sudan forward. Details coming up also. Clashes broke out in Zimbabwe's capital after protesters hit the streets despite an official ban. And for the first time, Congolese officials have confirmed at least 2 Ebola cases in South Kivu province. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, police got court approval for their ban of an opposition planned protest today in Harare's central business district. But some of the demonstrators showed up anyway to decry the country's economic meltdown. Security forces beat them with batons, used tear gas to disperse them, and arrested dozens. Reporter Kudzai Zinwashi has more details.
The build-up to the planned protests was characterized by abductions and torture of opposition and civic society members and political grandstanding between government wings and the opposition. Yesterday evening, government notified the opposition that the demonstrations were not authorized. Zimbabwe Republic Police Assistant Commissioner Paul Nyati appeared on national television advising the public not to join in.
The regulating authority for Harare Central District, who is also the officer commanding Harare Central District, has issued a prohibition notice after a consultative process which ended this afternoon. Anyone who is going to participate or to engage in the so-called demonstrations tomorrow will be committing an offense.
The last-minute ban of the protest prompted the opposition to quickly seek an audience with the courts. Tendai Biti, vice president of the opposition movement for democratic change, shared his disappointment at the court's ruling to uphold the prohibition and encouragement for the opposition to seek recourse in lower courts.
We differ respectfully with the ruling of the High Court. We will not appeal to the Magistrate Court because we do not accept the correctness with great respect of the ruling by the High Court of Zimbabwe.
The court order and heavy police presence didn't stop some of the people who had already answered the opposition call to demonstrate. Everson Moyo was one of the participants.
This is based on the current economic situation in this country, whereby everything is just getting from bad to worse on a daily basis. I believe that it's high time that we as citizens are involved in the future for our country, because leaving politicians and individuals to determine and decide the way forward for our country is not just an ideal thing to do.
Opposition leader Nelson Chamisa said the police's handling of the notification to protests in Harare was deceptive and a betrayal of the hope that flourished after long-time leader Robert Mugabe was forced out of office.
So what is clear is that we have seen scenes and circumstances of extreme brutality by the police, especially against the ordinary people. We have had over 80 people arrested. The number is still increasing because we are recording the information as it is coming. We've also received cases of abductions since Tuesday. What is clear is that it's turning out that the regime in Harare is far worse than the Mugabe regime.
Chamisa, who claims he was robbed of victory in 2018 presidential elections, says planned protests will proceed in other towns and that today's action was a hint of what's to come. Meanwhile, the aftermath of today's protests will play out in the courts for those who were arrested today. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinamashe from Harare.
The protracted negotiations between the Transitional Military Council, TMC, which has ruled Sudan since April, and the opposition alliance known as the Forces of Freedom and Change, FFC, seem to have worked. Sudan's main opposition alliance will nominate an economist who has served in international institutions to be prime minister in the country's transitional government. I first asked our reporter in Khartoum, Naba Mohadin, to tell us more about the nominee a day before the military-civilian deal for running the country for the next 3 years is signed.
Yes, the nominee is Dr. Abdullah Hamdok. He is one of the Sudanese who had a good influence in Africa. He is a public administrator who served for 7 years in United Nations Commission for Africa as a former executive secretary. And he was introduced to Sudanese when he rejected to serve al-Bashir regime when the regime was falling apart. And the last time, it's September 2018, when al-Bashir tried to appoint new people to end the economic crisis. So he rejected to be the finance minister, as he thinks that al-Bashir, he just want to exit, find an exit from the crisis, not to solve the political situation. He was nominated as a prime minister months ago, and protesters pushed to be named as a prime minister. They put great hopes that he is the right man in the right position to fix the unstable situation in the country.
Okay, the right man in the right position. Dr. Abdullah Hamdok, now that he's the nominee for the prime minister, does that mean that the Transitional Military Council will be dissolved?
Yes, TMC will be resolved on Sunday, one day after signing the agreement. As long as the prime minister is announced and the government is announced, TMC will be dissolved.
So the opposition alliance, besides the new prime minister, has it nominated any other officials?
This was the discussion and talks were about during the past weeks, because protesters pushed that the ministry councils and the sovereign council will be formed of whether the national symbols in the sovereign council or qualified technocrats in the ministers council. So the opposition parties will be represented in the legislative council to monitor the transitional period and to have time to build its social basis to be ready for the next election.
The FFC and Transitional Military Council are expected, like you said, to put the final signatures on the constitutional declaration tomorrow at a ceremony in Khartoum with foreign dignitaries attending. Talk to us a little about that. What are the expectations tomorrow?
Expectations tomorrow that it will be a very big day and a significant day for Sudanese after 8 months of protests and 4 months of turmoil and talks when talks started with the TMC. So tomorrow there will be very big celebrations organized by the military council and by opposition also in different urban places in the country. After signing the agreement, it's expected to be in afternoon. Celebrations will be in the country. People will go spontaneously, but in the same time there is a planned celebration and there is very big attendance for international media and regional media also. Also, there is some news said that some of African presidents will attend the signing of the agreement. So it will be a significant day for Sudanese after the ups and downs and the turmoil had happened, but at least an agreement that has signed, a new government is named, and this is, at this point, we can say the former regime is finally removed, because at least Sudanese right now, they have a civilian government that they fought for 8 months.
So Naba, protesters are celebrating what they saw as the victory of their revolution, and the generals are taking credit for averting the civil war. How is the mood in Khartoum and across the country right now?
Actually, the mood in Khartoum and in the country was changing from a week to another. There is a lot of events took place. Whenever there is violent events, people want to stop the talks with the soldiers. And whenever there is very bad crisis, like economic crisis or health crisis, people wanted to move on the talks to build the civilian government. So really, people are so confused. But with this agreement, they are happy because they think this is a victory as long as the prime minister and the minister's council at least will be technocrats. So they put great hopes that they might change the situation and that they might at least they might evaluate the risk and challenge of the transitional period in order to build social and justice transition institutions to support the comprehensive democratic change in the country.
That was our reporter Naba Mohadin talking to me from Khartoum. Women were a key part of protests that pushed Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir out of power in the volatile transition period after his fall. However, some female leaders now say they have been pushed aside and expect women will fill few positions of power. In Khartoum, Isha Sarai and Naba Mohadin spoke with female politicians and feminists.
In Sudan, women are well represented in the workforce, and they are not lacking in any public spaces, making up more than half of the protest crowds demanding more of their new transitional government the past few months. But many women, like Nahid Bustami, who was on the forefront of the movement to oust longtime President al-Bashir, say they are worried that women's rights will not be taken seriously by the new government. Bustami says that though there are some women in the transitional government, as a feminist, she doesn't feel they represent her interests. Some women have been fighting for a 50% quota for women in the transitional government's legislative council. But even 40%, a lower compromise, has not been met. Haifa Farouk is a member of the Sudanese Professionals Association, a labor union that played a significant role in talks around forming the new government. She continues protests against the SPA, saying they have not pushed hard enough to represent the women who were instrumental in larger protests. Farouk says women's roles in the negotiations during the revolution was far less than she had hoped. She says both working for and protesting the SPA has helped push the labor union in the right direction, as SPA officials encourage people to protest and make their requests heard. Often, officials will go outside to meet protesters directly to hear their demands. As for the weakened role of women in the new government, SPA spokesman Rashid Said says that full equality will take time. Said says that he encourages women to continue protesting. He also said that the fact that their demands were not met proves that the past few months do not constitute a full revolution, and that the opposition was still forced to compromise on some issues with military forces. But some women doubt the SPA and other unions are fighting for women's best interests. Namit Koko, a former politician and feminist researcher, explained that while some male opposition leaders were detained, women led the protests on the streets. But when the men were released, they returned to their leadership positions. Koko says patriarchal values still dominate Sudanese society, which, she believes, led the men to resume their leadership roles without acknowledging women. Since the 1980s, when Sharia law was imposed, affecting mostly the rights and freedoms of women, Sudanese women have felt oppressed, according to Koko. And as turmoil continues in the nation, women are unwilling to remain silent and underrepresented. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Khartoum.
18 past the hour, you're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Congolese officials have confirmed at least two Ebola cases in South Kivu province for the first time. The provincial government says a 26-year-old victim died and one of their children is still alive after testing positive for the disease. The year-long Ebola outbreak in Congo has killed more than 1,800 people in two provinces to the north. Treating the virus has been a challenge because of ongoing civil strife in the area. In addition, many people do not believe Ebola is real. Instead of seeking medical care, they may choose to stay home, which allows the virus to spread. Anti-Ebola efforts have also faced adversity from residents suspicious of the stringent protocols for burial of victims. The current outbreak is the most deadly since the two-year outbreak in West Africa that started in 2014 and killed more than 11,000 people. The UN Refugee Agency warns more than 360,000 people who have fled intercommunal violence in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo's Ituri province over the past 2 months are living in squalor, struggling to survive. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The violence in the DRC's Ituri province, which erupted between the Hema and Lendu ethnic groups over land and other resources in mid-June, is not as acute as it was then, but it has not gone away. To complicate matters, other armed groups have joined the fighting. UNHCR spokesman Baba Balash says thousands of people continue to flee, though at a lower rate. He tells VOA agency staff who recently visited the town of Jugu found empty villages with many homes burned and abandoned. He says many of the displaced are afraid to return home.
People who have tried, or relatives who have tried to return to their villages and to their homes, they have been reportedly attacked and killed. Displaced people are saying that they have lost relatives who were even trying to go and bring back some possessions from their houses or from their villages.
Balash says people in overcrowded towns and villages are forced to find shelter wherever they can. He says many are sleeping in the open, while others have converted local schools and churches into large squalid dormitories. Ituri, along with North Kivu province, is in the throes of an Ebola outbreak. World Health Organization spokesman Christian Lindemeyer tells VOA no case of the fatal disease has been detected among this large displaced population. While no specific precautions are being taken, he says treatment centers are operational. He says health workers who are on the alert try to make both the fleeing and migrating populations aware of the risks.
The scenario of a highly mobile population on the run is something which has been underlying in this response since the beginning, which is why it is so difficult to end it.
The UNHCR says the most urgent needs are for shelter, water, sanitation, health care, and food. It warns poor hygiene is increasing the risk of diseases spreading among the displaced. It says women and girls are at high risk of sexual violence and need protection. The agency reports it lacks the funds to deal with this humanitarian crisis in the DRC. It says it has received only one-third of its $150 million appeal and is urging the international community to fill this gap. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A Nigerian cleric, Sheikh Ibrahim El Zakzaki, is returning home after a medical trip to India. His supporters had been holding daily protests in the streets of Abuja until his departure earlier this week. For a look at Zakzaki's return, the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, a Shia Islamic group closely allied to Iran, VOA Salem Salomon has this story.
Controversial cleric Sheikh Ibrahim El Zakzaki said he is returning home to Nigeria after a brief trip to India, where he had flown to seek medical treatment. The news came as a surprise to supporters who had celebrated his departure earlier in the week. He has been held by Nigerian authorities for nearly 4 years, but had been granted medical leave while awaiting trial. While in detention, he has had two strokes and is losing his sight, the BBC reported. In a video statement posted on Twitter, the 66-year-old Shia cleric said he had been informed by Indian regional authorities that he was being returned to Abuja, Nigeria. We hope this is the best decision for us, he said in a translated and subtitled statement. Zakzaki is the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, a Shia Islamic group closely allied to Iran. He has long been distrusted by Nigerian authorities and was held as a prisoner for 9 years in the 1980s and 1990s. In 2015, the Nigerian army clashed with his supporters, killing about 350 people. Zakzaki and his wife were both wounded in the battle Seattle, and he has been detained since. His supporters have demanded his release with periodic protests, which security forces have violently suppressed. John Campbell is a senior fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He said Zakzaki may have not liked the strict terms of his trip. Zakzaki wished to be checked into a hotel upon arrival in India, Campbell said, but instead was taken directly to a hospital and surrounded by security personnel, restricting his ability to move freely in the country.
Apparently, what he had wanted to do in India was to resume essentially his political activity. And so he anticipated being unfettered and found himself to be very fettered indeed. And that, I think, is at the heart of his discontent.
Online, Zakzaki's supporters claimed authorities had forced him to return to Nigeria for political reasons. In an email response to VOA, the Indian embassy in Nigeria highlighted social media posts in which the embassy refuted claims the Indian and Nigerian government were working to keep Zakzaki unlawfully detained or deny him treatment. Estimates of the number of followers the IMN range from several hundred thousand to 3 million, Campbell said. He added that one concern is that Zakzaki's followers will become disaffected with the political process and take up arms. The worst-case scenario would be that they become an insurgency, similar to the radical Islamist group Boko Haram.
The concern is that if the Shia are radicalized, that is not going to be good. Now, there's a difference. Zakzaki has never advocated violence, whereas Boko Haram preachers have in the past. So that's a fairly important point. On the other hand, the concern has to be what happens if the Shia, in fact, start advocating violence.
The group had been holding daily protests in the streets of Abuja, but in an interview with VOA's Daybreak Africa on Monday, Ibrahim Gamawa, spokesperson of the IMN, said those protests would stop while Zakzaki receives treatment. He said the group is happy, but he added that the medical leave should have been granted long ago.
He will disappear from the streets of Abuja for the time being. We pray that our sheikh will come back healthier than he left the country.
Gamawa denied that the group has ever used violence, saying they are victims of violence by Nigerian authorities.
There is no single court in this country that convicted any of our members of either killing of any other person. We are victims of all these things that some disgruntled people. So we are victims of extremism. We are victims of political struggle. We are the endangered species in Nigeria.
Salim Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wojciech Zorniak, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.